From Artema Developer at www.artema.com, this is Leading Edge Java. In this Leading Edge Java audio interview, Artema's Bill Vinners and Frank Summers speak with Gavin King, the founder of the Hibernate Project, about Java, persistence, and relationships. Hello, this is Bill Vinners, Editor-in-Chief of Artema Developer, home of Leading Edge Java, the magazine for the advanced Java developer, at www.artema.com/lejava. Today I'm excited to bring you an interview with Gavin King, the founder of the Hibernate Project and Hibernate Project Lead at JBoss Inc. In this interview, Gavin discusses several Hibernate-related topics, including the relationship between Hibernate and EJB3, various strategies for collection fetching, why transparent persistence is a bad idea, and the role of caching in persistence architectures. This interview was recorded Thursday, June 31st, 2005, at the Java 1 Developer Conference in San Francisco, California. Okay, so we're in some room with Gavin King, the creator of Hibernate, and Frank and I want to talk about relationships. So, Frank, maybe you can... wait a minute. Before we do that, we should probably start... If you could give a little bit of context about Hibernate in general, and then we'll delve into some more depth.
Hibernate is... Okay, so Hibernate is an open source OWASP mapping solution. It's about maybe 3.5 years old, I guess partly by virtue of being open source, partly by virtue of the fact that by the kind of open source development process of working. Really developing this in conjunction with the user community, Hibernate became quite popular, it's now the situation with it as a project now it's part of the Hibernate team is now part of JBoss Inc. So we have a commercial aspect to the project. And we've also been, the Hibernate team's been, very closely involved in creation of the EJB3 spec. So, we've been trying to, bring the technology we've done in the open source community into the mainstream and try to use, the JCP to bring ORM technology to a much bigger audience than it would otherwise, see.
So I'm curious what's the future for Hibernate, in especially in the context of EJB3.
So, Hibernate forms the core of our EJB3 implementation, both as the JBoss EJB3 container and also as the Hibernate Entity Manager, which is an EJB3 persistence provider. There's a new role in the EJB spec, which is the role of a persistence provider. So we have a product branded Hibernate Entity Manager that is, basically a fairly small adapter from the EJB APIs to the Hibernate 3 core. Hibernate exists as a as the underlying implementation of our EJB product. Hibernate itself continues to exist because. There's a fairly long time lag between, having a new idea and being able to get it into the EJB spec, right? That's a lag of something like 2 or 3 years. So if we have new ideas and we want to do new things, the place that those things are going to go into is into, the Hibernate product with our, which continues having our, vendor-specific APIs. And, because we're an open source project, new people are, very comfortable continuing using, Hibernate as it is today.
So. Right, and so those folks will continue to have a path. Hibernate will continue to exist as Hibernate, but there'll be also EJB3 kind of. There'll also be an EJB3 API that I can talk to later that is using Hibernate under the covers.
Sure, I mean, both options exist today, as a matter of fact. So yeah, I mean, both paths exist. There are. you know, a large number of people, you know, out there who, you know, are constrained to use things that are blessed by the standard, or who care a lot about portability between, you know, different persistence vendors. And for those people, you know, EJB3 is a fantastic, you know, I really, you know, believe it's a great, you know, great API for them. It solves the kind of, you know, the 90% problems, you know, which is really what you need to solve in a spec, you know, and you know, for, you know, overwhelming majority of users, it's going to solve the overwhelming majority of their problems. And you know, and then, you know, when that fails, it's going to provide, you know, we're going to be able to provide easy, you know, exits to vendor specific functionality. But then there's plenty of people who are very happy using Hibernate as it is today, or else who are people with some kind of you know, more specific use cases where they really need the bleeding edge functionality, and they will, you know, really want the newest and greatest stuff. And I really think it's important for us to continue to foster a pattern where we have, you know, innovation that's going on in open source and in, you know, things which are done in the community, and that then, you know, slowly find their way into the standard, so that, you know, there's, you know, different kind of users there, and there's, you know, and that helps drive the standard forward.
What are some of the leading edge things in Hibernate that are not part of EJB3?
So in terms of, you know, in terms of our recent, you know, our recently released Hibernate 3, I think the biggest, you know, kind of coolest thing for us is our filters functionality, which is a feature for handling things like temporal data or regional data, things where there's some kind of cross-cutting concern that cuts across the data model, where we need to, you know, where we want to be able to subset the data, you know, the data that's visible to a particular user, to a particular transaction. You know, in a declarative way, for example, saying, you know, by saying, I want to see the data that was effective at, you know, June 12, 1974. And then, you know, for the rest of that transaction, whenever I run queries or navigate my object graph, you know, the data that's going to come back to me, is going to be, you know, have that constraint applied to it. So it's really, you know, it's a way of dealing with cross-cutting concerns like visibility or temporality. So that's you know, something we're very proud of, and that has big applications for some kind of people, for some kind of domains. We're introducing in Hibernate 3.1 some interesting functionality for dealing with, you know, more, you know, I think, you know, Hibernate's been, you know, and ORM have been great solutions for, you know, traditional kind of OLTP type processing. And what we started to see now is that a lot of people have said, hey, you know, actually this technology works really well in OLTP, and now we want to try and use it for everything. And what we're seeing, and they're trying to use it for things like, you know, more bulk style processing. And they're starting to see that some of the assumptions that we made, you know, they're sort of break down. And so, you know, what we're pushing for within 3.1 is to try and develop APIs which step back a bit from the full ORM kind of view of the world, and, you know, back to something that's a bit more of a, you know, appropriate for a streaming API for streaming data in and out of the database.
Can I just ask, what's OLTP?
Online transactional processing. let me think. We also, another big thing that's in Hibernate 3, and I'm not sure, you know, going forward how, you know, really how widely this is going to be adopted by a user base. You know, traditionally ORM has been seen to be, you know, in a very narrowly defined sense of mapping, you know, POJO, you know, plain objects, you know, defined in a very type safe way.
Don't be afraid to use acronyms. It's okay.
to a relational schema, right? But actually, you know, we're kind of realizing that, well, you know what? You know, POJO's and not always the best way. It's not always the most convenient way to represent data in my application. And so we're trying to provide, you know, as much support as we can for, you know, some different ways you might want to work with data in memory. You know, for example, XML is one. You know, in some kind of applications, it might be sense to have a completely D-type model where, you know, data is essentially just hash maps. You know, for example, you can imagine, once we really see a desire for this from our user base, we could support SDO as the memory level object model. You know, as a native, you know, we get SDOs natively in and out of the database using Hibernate. So you know, it's kind of unclear to me how big this will be in the long run. But really, you know, the kind of we've separated, the notion of mapping objects to the persistent store from the notion of how those objects are actually, you know, what those objects actually look like, what the actual in-memory representation is. So we have abstracted notions of attributes and entities. So that's something which I can't imagine being part of EJB for quite a long time. But we'll see. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, there's some really good use cases for reading data out of the database's XML, right?
So what was SDO?
SDO is an IBM and BA-led effort called Service Data Objects. It's, I'm sure my understanding is not less than 100%, but the way I think of it is it's a way of representing data in a way that it can be easily externalized between systems and have, you know, and be changed, you know, at various, you know, places in a distributed system and have changes tracked. And also I think it's intended as a way to, you know, abstract data coming from different kinds of sources like XML, and different kinds of databases.
So I just wanted to mention, we talked to, well, Frank actually interviewed Rob Jingle a couple years ago about the JCP, and it was called froth and compatibility because he kind of, you know, wanted a process that enabled innovation and stuff, and then there's also standards, which is kind of reminded me of that article when you were talking about Hibernate is where you're going to do the sort of new stuff and solve problems and just solve them. But then it takes a while for it to get into the standard. So shall we talk about relationships? All right, Frank. No, you go ahead.
Well, I mean, one of the issues that we could see with using Hibernate, but also I think it's probably generally OR mapping problem, is obviously, you know, collection fetching as to when you would fetch a collection in memory. Yeah. So suppose that you have this person object and the person, say, has emails as a collection. And then in Hibernate, you can say there's a lazy mapping of that collection, so it would be fetched. But the problem that we encounter sometimes is that the session has to be in effect when that fetching occurs. So when this person object gets detached, and then it would be more complicated to do that. So could you please comment on that a little bit? Or
yeah, sure. So you know, this is a common problem that new users of Hibernate, you know, come up against is the most simplest way that we tell people to manage their Hibernate sessions, their, you know, persistence contexts, is to start a Hibernate session at the beginning of a transaction, do the work you're interested in doing, close the Hibernate session, and then just use the objects that they retrieved and send that to the layer which renders the view, right? And then what they find is that the view needs to access some data that they didn't already access in the transaction. And that data is not there. All they have is a little proxy to the data, and it blows up. Okay, so you know, the immediate reaction of I think some people who are, you know, perhaps less, you know, used to thinking about transactions and distributed systems is that what Hibernate should do is go back to the database, open up some new connection to the database, start a transaction, and fetch that data. And then when we access another collection, we're going to go back, get another connection, start another transaction, fetch some more data. Now, what you really get back to if you start looking at that kind of approach to things is EJB entity beans from, you know, 2.1, right? Where we had this notion of remotely accessible entity data, right? Where I could, you know, have a reference to data that was really kept on the server side, and I'd go back and call getter methods and fetch data in a very fine-grained way, which resulted in lots of little transactions that fetched small amounts of data. And we know that that just doesn't perform or scale, that it doesn't, you know, implement correct transaction isolation semantics, right? So there are two possible approaches, right? Now, the first one is the architecture that we use to get away from those problems in EJB, in EJB 2, which is that I have, well, in EJB 2, the way you tended to talk about it was that I have an assembly, I have a layer of data transfer objects. So what I'd do is I'd have a session facade that would access some data off some entity beans, push that data into some other objects which I could externalize, and then return those externalizable objects back. So what's changed with Hibernate? Well, we've got Pojos. So what does a DTO for a Pojo look like? Oh,
Pojo.
It looks like the Pojo, right? So there's no reason for the DTO. But see, there was an implicit thing, an implicit extra thing there, the copying stuff across bit. That's the assembly phase. So DTOs didn't only just do externalization. They were also required an implicit assembly phase where I assembled the entity the data off the entity, off the database, into the transfer objects. So you can't escape that assembly phase just because you don't have the DTOs. So you still need to write your transactions, and the way you need to think about it is that the method I'm invoking remotely on the server has a strict contract about what data it will fetch for the client and what data will be available to the client, just like DTOs had a strict contract, right? And so you have to think about, you know, when you're designing a system that uses this kind of approach with detached objects, you have to think about that, right? So that, you know, I'm calling a method, and the contract of this method is it's going to return me an order with the line items and the products. And, you know, the implementation of that might do an efficient query which says, you know, get me the order, left join fetch the items and the line items and the products, or else it might just get the order and then later you know, make sure it explicitly initializes the association, right? So that's one solution, all right? And that's a solution where I'm working in an architecture which could be, you know, a physically separated architecture, you know, of a separate, you know, presentation tier to the transactional tier. Now, actually, we don't really believe in that, okay? I don't see a lot of good reasons to separate, you know, the presentation tier physically from the business tier, from the tier which does the transactional work. In fact, I think it's, you know, it's a big bug in the old style J2EE architecture that there was no way for me to have simultaneous access to the web request context, you know, to state associated with the web request and transactional state associated with transactional resources. So, you know, and this is something that really contributed a lot to the expense of J2EE systems, this idea that I can never have them both at the same time, and that if I want to do stuff that requires state from both places, you know, contextual state from my thread and state from the transactional resource, that I have to be, you know, pushing bits of stuff back and forth between the tiers, right? So what happens if I kind of give that up, right? And the answer is that what I can think about doing then is working with a system more where I have a persistence context that spans the rendering of the view. Now, there are some problems with that, all right? There are some problems with accessing data during view rendering, because accessing data is a thing that often results in exceptions. However, there are some things you can do to work around that, and in principle, you know, the idea of having, you know, that if you have the view rendering co-located with the transactional access in the same process space, you know, you can extend a persistence context pass. So that's, you know, you see some kinds of Hibernate applications, you know, do that today with this, say open session in view, right? Problem you always need to think about is the exception handling, you know, with that. So really, you know, what I kind of want to hint at with all that is that this is not some kind of missing feature out of Hibernate or something. It's actually a fundamental problem with building distributed systems where the data access takes place in a different process space from, you know, rendering the UI, and there is no easy workaround. You know?
That's a great answer. So,
Well, there's a couple, so many things I'd like to ask, but do you have any more time? Or it's been 18 minutes.
Yeah,
we can keep going a little bit further. Okay, so the second way. I mean, the first way, I think I kind of understand. The second way, I guess I'm concerned about the time I'm holding a transaction. Or, I mean, what's
I guess the assumption is that, you know, in an online app, the view rendering doesn't involve any user interaction or anything. I mean, we're going, getting some data, and then rendering the view, and then closing out transaction and going straight back to the user, right? Actually, one of the interesting things that we're trying to really push as an idea is, you know, and this is, you know, now in the EJB3 spec is a notion of an extended persistence context that spans the lifetime of a stateful session bean. It's a notion of persistence context which actually lasts much longer than that and actually span multiple user interactions, multiple atomic database transactions. And so I can actually, my objects never become detached, okay? They never become in that state that you were talking about of being unable to access their associations, because they remain managed and you know, in a persistence context that's live, and you know, the persistence, you know, implementation is managing, you know, can still do all the, you know, dirty checking and version checking. And I think that's a really nice, you know, we kind of, you know, I think we, you know, previously people, you know, used to think of stateful session beans as a very bad thing. You know, we had this idea that, you know, we want to go for these stateless architectures and, you know, people talk about REST and stuff like that. And frankly, I never understood any of that because I'm like, but what if my application has state? Then you put it in the database. So you're telling me that if I have state that's purely transient, just related to a short-term conversation with the user, that I have to go and stick that in the database? Yeah, I mean, that's silly. You know, that's just silly, right? There's no reason why I can't keep that in memory. And in fact, in Java applications, exactly what I do is keep it in memory. It's just that because everybody's been trained that stateful session beans are evil, what people are doing is sticking in the HTTP session. And it's like, but the HTTP session has no different performance implication to a stateful bean. The only difference is it's a big evil hash mappy thing with no kind of type safety, you know, with these named attributes, no kind of scoping to a particular conversation. You know, we see a whole raft of bugs in J2EE applications which come as soon as I open a second window in the same login session, right? And I mean, it should be the simplest thing on earth to avoid, right? You can go for a kind of a style of designing your application where each conversation with the user, maybe each window in a multi-window application, just adapts to a stateful session bean, which holds the state associated with that conversation.
So would you, in that case, put that sort of Hibernate session into the HTTP session, and you could share that inside the session?
Yeah, so that's the way if you were just using Hibernate. But, you know, what we're really working towards is, you know, using the EJB3 component model, and in that case, we have, you know, really declarative persistence context management, okay? So there's no more me trying to manage my little Hibernate session instance, okay? Really, the container's going to, under the cover, you know, take care of associating this, you know, Hibernate session, this persistence context, with the stateful session bean. So it's created when I create the stateful session bean. It's destroyed when I call the remove method of the stateful session bean. And you know, the way I get it is just via, you know, dependency injection. Right?
So. Okay, so if I do that, like you said, you're trying to push this idea a little bit of maintaining a session context over the course of several user interactions. Now I'm even more worried about the time that thing's. I mean, what is the cost of that? What's the downside?
But the point is that it's not actually an open database level transaction. There's no connection associated with that. We return the, you know, it has optimistic semantics, right? We're returning the connection to the pool, and you know, all we're holding on to is the, you know, is the state associated with the conversation.
That makes sense. So the other thing I wanted to talk about was kind of what Frank was, you know, talking about was an example of The other thing we were thinking about is to what extent can we make transparent persistence transparent to the app? So that example of, you know, having a get method that has these issues is sort of an instance of that class of issue, right? That, you know, normally if I made an object model, it would have a get emails in that user class. If I have to change that to, because I want to make these persistent, then I'm changing it. So sort of to what extent are ORMs going to make it so that I don't even need to worry about persistence, or to what extent do I have to change my, you know?
So I fundamentally do not believe in the notion of transparent persistence at all. You know, I believe strongly that all applications have to be built from the ground up to assume that they are managing persistent data, that is one of their main purposes in life, right? And that, you know, and that's what they do. Okay, so when I'm building, when I'm building a set of Java classes, I have to be thinking about, okay, I am creating entities here, and they map to a relational schema. And frankly, you know, if I'm seeing people building data models and not thinking about what that relational schema looks like, I honestly, you know, that scares me. I'm honestly thinking, you know, in the long term, you know, when what I have here is a legacy application, and that data needs to be shared to other things. I mean, Java has, you know, how much more of an effective lifespan do you think Java has? I mean, it's been around for 10 years now. I mean, how long do programming languages, what's the half-life of a programming language, right? You know, in a few years' time, Java is a legacy language, and we need to access this data from somewhere else. And trying to act as if the data model is not important, and that persistence is not important, is, you know, just a path to, you know, to failure, right? To you know, so really, you know, I think it's important to architect your application around the notion that, you know, I am getting data in and out of a database. In fact, a relational database, even more. And you know what? You get all kinds of nice things if you assume that, right? You get, you know, a database can give you all kinds of nice analytics that you can do on your data. You know, I think, you know, sometimes I wonder if one of the big failing of a lot of, you know, typical web applications today, especially things that have been, you know, built with stuff like EJB, CMP, they actually really don't do a lot of nice reporting and analytics and stuff upon the, you know, they have a very narrow, you know, kind of OLTP kind of function, you know, and you know, I really think that we could do a lot more in terms of building analytics and reporting into the kind of flow of using the application.
All right, so I guess it's been 27 minutes. You got to go, right? So, all right, well,
we have one final question.
But be careful. Frank has a final question, then a final question, then a final.
Is this the final?
No, go ahead, Frank.
Because I think you were.
Oh, about cache through architectures. Yeah, basically, Hibernate has a second level cache, mm-hmm. And so if you know, it needs an object, it looks it up in the first level cache. If it's not there, it goes to the second level cache if there is one,
yep.
And that can be configured. And I kind of get the sense that you guys, sort of your philosophy is that, you know, caching is a performance optimization. Maybe try it without it, and then add it as.
Yep.
So Cameron Prady talks about cache through architectures, where mm-hmm. where kind of you would just turn off the second level cache on the ORM and talk. The app would write not to the ORM, but the app would write to the cache, and the cache would call into a cache load cache store. What's your?
Well, I mean, I guess it's natural for someone who's a cache vendor to think that the cache is central to the universe, and someone who's an ORM vendor to think that the ORM is central to the universe. So, I mean, to me, a cache is typically something that doesn't have, that's not queryable, right? So fundamentally, I think that the database is the true representation of the world, because A, it's queryable, B, you know, once you start having data distributed across a cluster, there's all kinds of problems to do with consistency that are made a lot easier if we assume that there is one true representation, right? You know, in the database. So to us, the cache is kind of something that, you know, sits off a little bit to the side that we can use to optimize the conversation between the, you know, the application and the database.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.